The Koi Gig Pod.
You know, for a first World Cup, I think they've done excellently. But then you think of how close they were and what if this, which is a great sign.
Subscribe to the feed in the OTB Sports app now.
The Football Show on Off the Ball
with William Hill. Who you got? 18 plus. See gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
Now, you're welcome along. Premier League season is upon us once again. Manchester City away to Burnley kicks things off for the now traditional Friday night start. I should mention once again, Premier League commentaries are here every Sunday and Off the Ball, including Chelsea-Liverpool at Stamford Bridge on this opening weekend coming, and not to mention all our football shows across the season to preview the year ahead. Very happy to say Mr. Philippe Auclair is with us. Philippe, hello.
Hello.
And Jonathan Wilson as well. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. So, Philippe, we go again.
Yes. Well, yes, we haven't stopped going, haven't we, anyway? Yes, well, here we go again. And for a season which I must say I'm struggling a little bit to understand, well, not to understand, but to predict anything. So I've just warned you here that don't expect absolutely incredible, life-transforming predictions for what is going to happen. Probably something much tighter than last season, perhaps something like that, with not just two clubs in it, but actually quite looking forward to it, I must say.
Yeah, same. Jonathan, do you agree something tighter than last season in terms of the title race and more teams involved?
Will it be tighter? I'm not sure whether it'll be tighter, but I think what's interesting, yeah, Manchester City, despite losing Gundogan and Mahrez, are clearly still the best squad. I would still expect them to win the league, and if they do, and it's six titles in seven seasons, I think that is a problem for the Premier League. But what comes after that, I think, is really interesting. This time last year, nobody thought Arsenal would be as good as they were, and I think the squad looks stronger now, albeit they now have to balance out with Champions League football. You have to expect both Liverpool and Chelsea to be significantly better than they were last season. And I don't think there's any real reason to think that the likes of, I mean, maybe European football will affect Brighton, but you sort of hope Brighton will keep going and they'll still be challenging for top six, top seven. Newcastle, see what happens with them with Champions League football. I think there's lots of interesting subplots below Manchester City. My fear is that City just walk away with it, and come February, March, where we're sort of thinking, right, where's the drama here? Is City already 15 points clear?
Yeah, to play devil's advocate for a moment, because I suspect Philippe agrees with you that six out of seven for City does represent a problem. Is it that big a problem if we're getting good title races? The year City held off Liverpool was one of the great seasons. If it's some way tight this year through until May and there's a genuine title race as opposed to, I don't know, a PSG running away with the league as a foregone conclusion, that feels like less of a problem, and that not all of those six in seven are the same.
Look, you're right. It is less of a problem than a Bayern situation or a PSG situation where, okay, I mean, Bayern, I know anyone on the final day of last season, but where they have been winning it by the end of March. However, this is only the third time. Last season, only the third time that a team had won a fifth title in a 6-year period. You're testing my memory on the stat here, but I think City had averaged, I think it was something like 15 points more than when United did it, and then I think maybe something like 23 points more than when Liverpool did it. And that, I think, is the problem. That even if they are being challenged by one team, or even if they're being challenged by two or three, if you have such a gulf between the top and, not even the bottom, but the top and sort of say fifth, sixth, I think that does become an issue. I don't think that'll happen, because I think you look at those teams we're ranking between sort of second and eighth, say, and at this stage, they look pretty well balanced. I think Villa, the team I haven't mentioned, who I think, yeah, second half last season were brilliant. I think they bought very well, and they, I think, I don't think they're going to get in the top four, but they certainly could be challenging for top six. So that is interesting, but the danger is that City are just just streets ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
I think until Guardiola leaves, yes, we'll continue to be an issue.
Yeah. To what extent would it be a problem for you, Philippe? Because the masses around the world are more engaged with this league than ever.
I don't necessarily share Jonathan's opinion that City are that clear favourites. It's tempting the devil to make presumptions right now before the end of the transfer window. But what I would say is that they haven't had the greatest of transfer windows. They've lost two key players. Jonathan mentioned, you know, Riyad Mahrez and Ilkay Gundogan going. We're talking of two players who are absolutely central to what they've achieved over the past 6 or 7 years. Obviously, everybody will say yes for Gundogan, particularly last season, where we remember, you know, his exploits in May when he scored doubles against Leeds and Everton, the double in the final of the FA Cup, the fact that he was genuinely the captain on and off the field of that team, and he's a huge loss, and he hasn't been replaced. But I think we also tend to forget that Riyad Mahrez, even if he didn't feature much in the run-up to the Champions League title, was also a very important figure in the Premier League. And they're going to miss those two players an awful lot. And I don't see that they have replaced them. And yes, they have reinforced, as they do every year, with one star acquisition, which is Guardiola in this particular case, with Kovacic coming as well. But I do think that their squad at the moment, and I say at the moment, we are not at the end of the transfer window, looks thinner than it has been for a while.
Yeah.
That you are waiting to see what the impact of finally getting the European title, having done the treble, is going to have psychologically on this group of players, which is quite a small group of players compared to previous Prime Manchester City squads. So I'm not saying that they're going to have a problematic season. No, they're going to be obviously at the top of the table or towards the top of the table. I'm saying that it's going to be a bit perhaps more difficult for them than you would expect or you would have expected for quite a while.
Yes. And sorry, you may have misheard my question when I was saying problematic. I was just almost trying to wrap up Jonathan's initial point that if City win their sixth out of seven seasons, that's problematic for the league. To what extent do you agree with that?
It is. It's totally problematic. Even if
we get great title races and great seasons and engaging seasons which go through until the final week or two.
How many of those have we had? I mean, we were talking about, yes, the two seasons with Liverpool and last season, true, because of Arsenal's exceptional showing.
Yeah.
But other than that, there have been far too many processions. And also, when you have a procession of two clubs, it's not necessarily what makes for a great season. What makes for a truly great season is when you have three or four clubs vying for the title.
Mm.
And sometimes a one-horse race can be thrilling, like what happened with Napoli in Serie A was absolutely thrilling because it was Napoli. We are not in this situation. When you have a club which is on its way to win a sixth title in 7 years, you have a big problem.
Yeah, okay.
Especially when you are selling this competition to the rest of the world on the basis of its competitiveness. And you are basically telling everybody, we're not just the best in Europe, but in England, everybody can beat everybody, which is, of course, completely untrue. It's not the case. And you're deflating the image and the perception that people have of this league. And it is a problem, commercially speaking. It's a problem for the sporting interest. And yes, it is problematic. And I don't, which is why perhaps I'm being not the devil's advocate, but I'm on the side of the angels this evening. I'm saying I think it can change this season. I think Arsenal are stronger. I think Manchester United are certainly stronger and have recruited well. I'm also expecting Liverpool to come back if they don't have the same injury problems they've had certainly last season. There are some unknowns, how Newcastle will cope with the Champions League. Can Tottenham do anything? I doubt it. How will Aston Villa, which is has done very good recruitment, a feature being in Europe as well. I mean, you could imagine the situation in which, yes, you have more teams beating more other teams than has been the case in the recent seasons. That's why I'm hopeful for something a bit tighter.
Okay.
Even if, by the way, in recent history, if you look at the table, Manchester City won the title with only 89 points, which by their standard was almost ridiculously low.
Yeah. To beef up Philippe's point, Jonathan, about Gundogan and Mahrez. We're talking 51 and 47 games played across the season. Gundogan involved in 18 goals, scored 11, 7 assists, and Mahrez involved in 28 goals, 15 scored and 13 assists. So they are suddenly removed. There was a worry Kyle Walker would follow them out the door. It now would appear he is staying. So your view on City replacing those two, and maybe if I could, you might work in your thoughts on Phil Foden into that, because he's been talked about a lot in advance of this season. Is this his time finally at 23 to become the player people have felt he would be? By that I mean central cog, plays every game, be that in central midfield or on the right hand side if he can elbow Bernardo Silva out of the way. So your broad thoughts on City on those points?
Yeah, I mean, to take the first point first, I think what Mahrez and Gundogan gave City last season and previous season as well, it's not just their quality as players, and Philippe touched on Gundogan's captaincy, which is hugely important, but they were players who, on the odd occasion when City got bogged down in games, they were capable of breaking the game. So, I mean, Gundogan that last sort of 6 weeks of the season just kept doing it, as he had done the previous season, and that's a hugely useful tool to have, to just be somebody who scores key goals in the last 6 weeks of the season. But Mahrez as well, I mean, I think it was the league game at Stamford Bridge against Chelsea, before it became obvious that things had gone awry with Potter, when Chelsea had actually, without playing particularly well, had sort of held City, and suddenly Mahrez breaks the game open, gets the goal, and it all changes. And I think, you know, he's the quickness of his feet, his ability to beat a man, Bernardo Silva, I think, is a brilliant footballer, but he doesn't quite have that same unpredictability that Mahrez has. So that, I think they may miss that. And then it's how that works in terms of Foden. You know, on the right-hand side, they're clearly short. Now, maybe Cole Palmer can come in and do that. Obviously, scored a lovely goal in the Community Shield. But if he doesn't, then they're very much having to play Bernardo Silva out there. And that means he's not covering for Kevin De Bruyne. And that means somebody else has to. And that, at the minute, has to be Foden. So, Foden, I think, is a brilliant player. I really hope, for his sake, for England's sake, for sake of just watching football as I like watching, I hope he has a good season. And I guess I hope he does it in the middle, because if he doesn't, it means he's taking Jack Grealish's place, and I love watching Grealish as well. So can he do it on the right? I don't know. I mean, he has played occasionally on the right without being hugely impressive. So it may be that's something that he suddenly can do. But my suspicion will be that if he does have a regular role, it'll be centrally with Bernardo Silva playing outside him on the right.
It's funny, you know, I was a bit surprised by the stats, because not that last season by any means feels like a lost season for Foden, but I was surprised. If you compare him and Grealish played 50 games, Foden played 48, and scored 10 more goals than Grealish last year, and they're pretty similar on assists, which I had to double check, just because it is like, it's written off as, God, Foden 22 didn't quite happen for him, but he had like 15 goals, 8 assists, and played nearly 50 games. It's just maybe those more important junctures.
He started the season very well. Oh, yes. He's got a hat-trick against Manchester United, I think probably the World Cup and then what followed has sort of coloured the judgment there. Yeah. And I think that's a real danger when you're looking back at last season. They went on for so long that anybody can remember the whole season is some kind of genius.
And do you think
there's long periods that season that I've disappeared from my mind already.
Yeah. And do you see, Foden has been always talked about as like, he will migrate to central midfield and dictate things in the most extraordinary manner. That was one of the great hopes for him. Like at 23 now, that kind of, we're waiting a touch for him to do that. Do you see him ultimately as becoming a central player, Philippe?
Yes, I would think so. Even though I have to say I'm a bit like Jonathan here, I'm trying to remember the season as we're talking. Previous seasons, my God, it never ended, did it? Yes, he does have that. But there's another player I'd like to put in the mix, by the way.
Yeah,
Julian Alvarez. Because who can play at almost every single position in the forward line? He can play midfield as well. In terms of his defensive work up front, I think he's actually the best in the Manchester City squad. So I would expect to see a lot more of him. But for Foden, it's a bizarre one, because There was this point in the season, which obviously we all suffer from recency bias, when Pep Guardiola suddenly identified something he'd never identified, I think, throughout the whole of his life or his career as a manager, which is something resembling a starting 11. And you will remember, I think it was from the RB Leipzig game in the Champions League, he suddenly started to select the same starting 11 at every big game. Mm. And Foden was not in it. And so I think it has tainted perhaps our view of that particular season, because also at the moment when City was actually doing things in Europe that they had never done before, he was not part of that scenario. He was not part of the script. He could have played perhaps a great part in the script. We'll never know about that. And I think our opinion is a little bit, you know, tainted by that. And quite naturally, because we, in a never-ending season, it seems like a very small moments of time, like a few weeks, a few months can feel like a couple of seasons. So, and judging Foden on the basis of a few months which were not quite as good as they should have been for him, but which were very good for his team, and obviously he's going to suffer from the contrast, is probably a bit unfair. So yes, you would expect him to be far more important. You would expect him to see him back perhaps in this position in midfield. But the point remains that you have a club which has just done a so-called historic treble, which will want to compete on all fronts, which is psychologically difficult, and which has demonstrably a thinner squad than it has had in the past. I think at the moment they've only got something like 16 senior players who are actually completely fit and ready to play. That is not much. And it's not saying that the youngsters who are coming through the academy are not any good. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when you compare it with previous Manchester City squads, it looks a little bit on the thin side in very, very relative terms. And also, again, compared to the efforts that some of their direct rivals have made in terms of recruitment, and particularly Arsenal, I mean, which is obviously the number one challenger, but also Manchester United.
Well, let's talk Arsenal then, Jonathan, if they are the number one challenger. Their business over the summer has been relatively smooth. There is a sense of a manager who's in control of the club and supported by the owners and Edu as well in the background. Declan Rice has been added to their midfield. They've paid €40 million for Timber in defence from Ajax. And then I guess Kai Havertz, we can pitch in as a very educated punt who may well do something. And they're looking at the Brentford goalkeeper, Raya, as well. And there is the sense that the Odegaard, Saka, Martinelli generation can only be better this season, and the group as a whole will benefit from the experience of last year. So you take all of that, you add it into the points about Gundogan and Mahrez out the door at City, and I guess that is a reason why, for instance, Gary Neville on the overlap tipped Arsenal to win the league this year. Where are you on that front? Where are you on Arsenal?
I mean, I think they can have a really, really good season and end up finishing fourth.
yeah.
So, there's a couple of things I just don't really understand about that squad. I mean, look, it's, I think the starting 11, the two or three reserves after that, all great. But I found it really weird that Havertz started up front in the absence of Gabriel Jesus on Sunday. That, you know, if you're not going to play Eddie Nketiah in that circumstance, when are you going to play him? What's he for? What's Nketiah still hanging around the club for? And maybe you do just see him as somebody who comes on for 15 minutes at the end and sort of can nick something. The continual reluctance to play Trossard from the start, unless he really has to, when, and I know these stats can be slightly misleading, but Arsenal's record with Trossard last season was extraordinary. It was much better when he started than when he didn't. And then, you know, obviously he ends up, I mean, I don't quite understand how he's been credited with what was obviously an own goal, but he seems to have been credited with it. So it's him who gets the decisive equaliser. I still think the midfield looks slightly thin. And we don't quite know what's happening with Thomas Partey, that suggestions he may leave late in the window, plus, you know, the other issues around him. So I still think it's slightly thin to challenge properly in both the league and the Champions League. But then I, you know, I thought they were extremely thin last season and they finished second. So it may be that whatever was clouding my judgment last year is still clouding it.
Yeah. Philippe, you see them as most likely to challenge City, you were saying?
Yes. I have a feeling that Manchester United is going to surprise us. Okay. But I would say definitely. I mean, in terms of how to manage a transfer, you know, a transfer window, I think this particular one has been one of the very best that Arsenal has had in a very, very long time, mm-hmm. really. Because it's not just about the new players coming in. It's also about all the key players extending their contracts. There seems to be a level of order and a level of calm within the club, which all goes extremely well. I mean, they're not as a huge squad, yes. But you should add, you know, when you have players like Emil Smith Rowe, for example, who was absolutely crucial a couple of years ago in what Arteta was starting to do, and who struggled, I mean, because of injury in part, but also because of competition for places to get a place in the starting 11. And you know that Mikel Arteta is thinking of deploying him perhaps in a slightly different role in midfield. They've also got one thing that not many other clubs have, which is a number of players who can score 10 plus goals in the Premier League a season. They will have, what, five now, I would say. How many clubs can say that? And provided, again, that that the key players stay fit, I do think they have a real chance to challenge. And I would say another thing, and it's not probably going to make myself very popular with Arsenal fans. Despite the huge popularity of Aaron Ramsdale for many, many reasons, I do think that getting David Raya is a big, big plus for them.
Right. Yeah. So you've mentioned Manchester United a few times, Philippe.
Yeah.
They finished third last year, up from sixth in 2022, Carabao Cup winners, FA Cup final. They've taken Mason Mount on board for 60 million, and then Andre Onana signed in goals.
Yep.
And Rasmus Højlund from Atalanta, 20 years of age, 9 goals in Serie A last season. So that's still a relatively big gap to close on City and Arsenal. Why are you so optimistic that Manchester United are going to kick on again?
I think the recruitment has been excellent, has addressed some key points. I don't think Haaland is a Haaland Mark II. You shouldn't expect him to score, you know, 50 goals a season. That's not the kind of player he is, but he's a superb link-up player. And Onana addressed a very urgent need at goalkeeper. Mason Mount has not just got the game, it's also got the personality that was needed. And I look through this, I think it's a very settled team in some ways. And you can feel a manager who is really putting his imprint on the squad. And again, there's an impression of calm and discipline about the way that things are going there, which is in sharp contrast with what's happened in the past. And when you see what he's been able to do with a team that was, I mean, remember the kind of team that he inherited, you know, remember the team that, you know, lost 4-0 to Brentford, was it, at the beginning of the season?
Yeah.
It's a completely different club now. And I know that at one point, you know, even people were talking about Manchester United, the possible candidate for the title in 22-23. It didn't quite happen. People say it was ridiculous to have said such a thing. They have progressed since then. So, yes, I mean, and I don't think either that their transfer window is finished, that, you know, the buying and selling is over as far as concerned, which is why it's always a bit brave on the 8th of August to make predictions for a season when we know that there are going to be massive changes happening in the next 3 weeks.
Jonathan Philippe mentions that Brentford game, which was a real baptism of fire period for Erik ten Hag, and there was an ill-judged De Gea pass out from the back in that particular game to Eriksen. So straight away, Onana, you feel, will have an impact on their style of play. It's more like, I with Højlund up front, a 20-year-old who scored 9 goals last year, and Philippe rightly says he's not an out-and-out goal scorer, but that number 9 jersey for Manchester United is much scrutinised, and to your points about this being the longest year of all time, Ronaldo arrived this time last year of the season. But in, like, up top, it's a lot to look to a 20-year-old to say, okay, do your best in that position. Like, it does feel like there's a gaping Harry Kane-sized hole in that squad still.
yeah, there is. But I sort of quite like what they've done. I think it's a risk, clearly, to pay that much money for a 20-year-old. And if he's going to be the first choice number nine, then that's an enormous gamble. But the way he's used to playing at Atalanta, he presses incredibly hard. And that is actually the most important thing. The goals are nice. You'd want 10, 15 from him. But you wouldn't be expecting him to get 20 or 25 the way I think Ten Hag wants to play, okay. Which is where somebody like Rashford becomes very important. I think, you know, Rashford contributing goals, Bruno Fernandes contributing goals, Mason Mount and Anthony or Ahmed Diallo. I mean, I know he's injured, which is a real shame, but he was really, really good for Sunderland last season. I worry if he's physically big enough because he's a tiny little lad, but his left foot, he's a really good finisher and very intelligent player, movement really good. And you can see why they've let Alanga go looking at Ahmed Diallo. So he could easily end up being the first choice on the right rather than Anthony. So it's a very young forward line. I mean, yeah, Rashford and Bruno Fernandes obviously a bit more experienced, and maybe this is a season too early, but I think bringing in Mason Mount, who had a pretty miserable season last season. I don't know how much stock you put by pre-season games, but I don't think he's been great in pre-season.
No.
But what we've seen before, tactically, he's very, very intelligent, very smart, and the sort of player that Ten Hag needs to play the sort of football he wants to play. And the thing this season, you know, as Philippe says, bringing in Onana, he can play the sort of football he wants to play. He's not being hamstrung by that. He's not constantly having to compromise because his goalkeeper can't do the job he wants him to do. So, I think it's probably too early for United to win the league this season, but I think they can have a real... Yeah, they for me, they're the most likely of the challenges.
Right. Okay. I mentioned I was listening to the overlap earlier, and it was interesting to get Gary Neville's read on the Harry Kane situation. So he thinks, and Carragher thinks, that Harry Kane would much rather be the Premier League all-time goal scorer than win a Bundesliga or two, and going to United maybe serves both masters and as a chance of a trophy. His read, Jonathan, and what's going on here is that he wants Daniel Levy to accept the 100 million from Bayern Munich, so that sets a price, and then he says, thanks Daniel, I'm not going to Bayern Munich, but United will pay 100 million and I'll go there. and that is the game within the game at the moment, and that, shock horror, Daniel Levy is completely wise to that. He knows if he accepts 100 million from Munich, Kane's going to say, I'm not going there. United come in with 100 million the next day, wink and a nod, done, and Levy's not going to be fooled by anyone. So it was really interesting to get the footballer's perspective on what's going on. What's your sense of how the Kane thing is going to play out?
It's very hard to know. I mean, I can sort of see the attraction in Munich for Kane, in that, you know, it's a new challenge for him. It almost guarantees him medals, which he's never had. But he's not somebody who's ever... How can I put this and be polite? Because I don't mean to be rude when I say this, but he doesn't seem a natural traveller. You know, he seems somebody who's quite happy at home in London. So Manchester, you know, he can be back in London regularly. Munich's not a massive culture shock, but he's still speaking English. It's still essentially an English way of life. So my instinct is he'd rather stay in England, and I think he probably now... I think for a long time, the idea of being the person who led Tottenham to a trophy really appealed to him.
Yeah.
And I think as that vision has faded post Pochettino, I think even Tottenham fans get that frustration. I don't think they blame him for wanting to leave. I can see they'd be a bit frustrated if he ends up with a Premier League rival. But even then, I think realistically people understand that, you know, he's done everything he possibly could to get Tottenham to win things, and the team this season clearly is not going to be challenging for major trophies.
Fellas, we're going to take a very short break. We're back with more from Philippe Auclair and Jonathan Wilson in just one second.
Football on Off the Ball.
With William Hill. Who you got? 18 plus. See gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome back. It's that time of year where we're looking ahead to the Premier League season. Very happy to say Jonathan Wilson and Philippe Auclair are with us. Philippe, we should talk about Liverpool, who have had an interesting 18 months, to say the least. So Jurgen Klopp said of the season ahead, "We played a bad season and we came fifth. Imagine we were more our normal selves, which we absolutely will be next season. We will be a contender again." That was how he signed off over the summer. They made a very nice start to the off-season. Alexis McAllister and Szoboszlai, the 22-year-old Hungarian captain, signed for midfield, and then out went Jordan Henderson, Fabinho, Milner, Naby Keita, Oxlade-Chamberlain. And so suddenly that midfield problem, which we all talked about a lot last year, is being talked about a lot again ahead of the new season. So I guess that certainly means Alexander-Arnold is going to be into that hybrid defensive midfielder role. How much bother are they in here from a midfield point of view, because certainly pre-season up front they've been great, they've been cooking up front, no problems at all, but that midfield problem has not been sorted out, or has it?
No, it hasn't, and which is one of the reasons why people in Liverpool are putting so much importance on the possibility of a transfer, of getting Romeo Lavia and bringing him in to strengthen that midfield, because it's quite clear that there is a problem there. And it's been a problem for quite a while, for many reasons. So aging midfielders, players who are not quite punching at the level which was hoped, Naby Keita and even Oxlade-Chamberlain with injuries and so forth. A few younger players who seem to impose themselves for a while, but didn't quite confirm the qualities they had shown and so forth. So there is still a big problem there in midfield. For the rest, absolutely no problem. There has been some talk as well of, you were talking about basically gazumping and Manchester United gazumping Kane's move to Bayern, which I found quite funny. There is also a theory going that Moises Caicedo could also be gazumped by Liverpool. I don't believe in that for one second, but I just thought that you would just mention it. But they do need to strengthen the midfield. There's absolutely no doubt about that. For the rest, up front, they look absolutely terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And it feels very much like an end of a particular period, and you would expect in those cases a season of transition, and which is maybe the way you can understand the arrival of McAllister and Szoboszlai. I actually should turn to Jonathan, the author of Behind the Curtain, for the correct pronunciation of Szoboszlai, because I'm not too sure, I have to say. Jonathan, how do you pronounce Dominic's second name?
Yeah, the S there in Hungary is just an S. But just because that sounds right to me doesn't mean it is true. I mean, Hungarian is... it's baffled far, far greater minds than mine.
But he will... I'm actually quite excited to see those players playing together, because one thing is that we're going to see very inventive play in the middle of the park with those two, with McAllister and Szoboszlai. That's for sure. But again, I would say one of the other questions that you will ask yourself is whether they will finally get over those constant injury problems they seem to have with their key players, which seems to be something which has accompanied Liverpool for quite a few seasons now, and for so long that you think that it's a little bit more than coincidence of chance or bad luck, which makes it that so many of their key players are unavailable for such long periods of time. So if this goes well, okay, fine. Yeah. You've also got Bajcetic, Bajcetic has shown some wonderful things. Again, he's one of those younger players who wonder what can be done of him. And you can see the potential there. I think they could be tremendously exciting at times, honestly. They will be tremendously exciting at times, and they will probably be better than last year. I saw a Liverpool fan, actually tongue-in-cheek, saying, we've got to improve on, like Salah's got to improve on his season when he had a dreadful record of 27 goals and 15 assists, which is the kind of standards we're judging that team by, which is not really quite right.
Yeah.
And But I have to say, for me, it's the unknown. It's the question mark. I do think they still need a couple of players, certainly one in midfield, to be able to really challenge within the top four and perhaps be a challenger for the title as well.
Yeah, and they're at Stamford Bridge on Sunday, which will be a really good litmus test because they started last year losing away at Fulham and it was dismissed as opening day a fumble, but turned into a pretty good indicator of where they were. Jonathan,
it was 2-2 that game.
Was it 2-2? I remember it as 3-0 for some reason.
No, they went 1-0 down and 2-1 down, but it was 2-2.
Oh my God, okay. Look, it was 8 years ago.
But so the conclusions we the conclusions we drew from it were
the same. It felt like 3-0.
Physically, they weren't right, yeah.
There's just a sense of something not quite right with Liverpool at large behind the scenes over the last, I don't know, let's call it 18, 24 months, where they've had any number of directors of football, certainly two, if not three, depending on whether you count one's return as a third, but a turnover in the transfer committee and a sense that because of Klopp or other reasons, just people are moving on. And then you have owners who aren't as willing to just diagnose a problem and spend a huge chunk of change to fix it, i.e. in midfield. Like, you still get a great sense that Klopp is energised. You still get a great sense that the players love Klopp and that actually this could be within their grasp again to go and really challenge for the title if they just sorted out this kind of glaring problem. And yet it's been allowed to drift here for a long time and then the Saudis come in and exacerbate the situation. So that's kind of pessimistic overview of Liverpool, but it does feel like they're kind of just hanging on here and as opposed to going out there and challenging.
I think that's slightly harsh. There were two games from the quadruple the season before last. So, yeah, they were two games having the greatest season in the history of football. If there's a downturn after that, I think that's not unexpected. It's not unusual. I think it was apparent to people, it has been apparent to people for 2 or 3 years that the squad was getting old together. They moved to address that with the forward line last season, but the injuries to Luis Diaz and to Jota really hampered that. And it was only that last sort of 2 or 3 months of the season when that really was the forward line looked like what they wanted it to look like. And by then they were sort of playing without pressure and also it almost counted against them. They had quite an easy run of fixtures at the end of the season. And so I think they went, was it the last 11 games went 2 draws, 7 wins, 2 draws?
11 unbeaten, yeah.
But I think in those 7 wins, I'm not sure they beat anybody that they wouldn't expect to beat. So you didn't quite know, was that just that, okay, we're not going to get the Champions League, there's no pressure, let's go out and batter this lot. Or whether that really can be carried forward into this season. I mean, certainly pre-season up front, it's looked very good. Again, with the caveat, what does pre-season mean? The midfield, I think, was obviously the area where they needed to work on in the summer. I suspect they would rather not have lost Henderson, that he's the one that there was no plan to move on.
Yeah.
But if you get offered 40 million quid for Fabinho after he had an appalling season last season, you're clearly going to take it. Naby Keita, partly because of injuries, but never really looked the player at Liverpool that he had done at Leipzig. Oxlade-Chamberlain, because of injuries, his time was up. So you've still got Thiago Alcantara hanging around to give a bit of experience there, but it's a very, very young midfield. It was too old last year and it might be too young this season. But having said that, I'm not really sure they're going to bring anybody else into that area, because they've got McAllister at 24, they've got Szoboszlai at 22, and then they've got Curtis Jones, who had a really good under 21 Euros for England. You've got Harvey Elliott, you've got Bajcetic. That's five really good players aged between, I don't know, is Bajcetic 19 yet? But between 18 or 19 and 24.
Yeah.
I think they might just be thinking, well, Klopp's proved it with young players before. Maybe this season's a season too early. But maybe the logic is that City are so strong that even if you brought in, I mean, Casado's also young, he's a bit more experienced, but even if you brought in an 80 million, 100 million pound midfielder, you're not actually going to win the league. So you might as well give these kids their head. And then the season after this one, or the season after that. But of course, the problem, and you touched on when you're talking about Klopp and about all the backroom changes, Klopp is a very bad loser. Maybe the worst loser in the Premier League. he's a totally different beast when he wins to when he loses. And we saw him last season you're snapping at really innocuous questions in press conferences. And you think, well, if he's doing that with us, when it's sort of his job to present, you know, the sort of the friendly, cuddly, polite face, what's he like behind closed doors? And I don't know, but you then start to speculate, is that why there's this turnover of backroom staff? If he's, you know, this bear with a sore head in training, maybe that's why players aren't quite responding to him in the way they had done in the past. And but you know, you have a bad run of results and you start looking for reasons and you see that. It's very, very hard as an outsider to know. I honestly don't know what the average shelf life of a data boffin at a club is. It's never bothered anybody until the last 2 years.
No.
Maybe they do just hang around for 3 or 4 years and move on. A lot of them, well, maybe not a lot, but some of them certainly don't have a background in football and they want to go back to whatever it was they had been doing. So, yeah, I think we'll get a far, far better idea of that in sort of 5 or 10 years when people who are there and on the inside feel empowered to tell us.
Who knows? Maybe it's a play hard, work hard, drinking, rock and roll kind of lifestyle and we just didn't realise that, you know?
I wish I'd been a data boffin then.
Philippe, I think, I don't want to delay you, I think you have to go.
That's all right. I can stay with you for 2 minutes, but maybe you've had enough of my drivel.
Not at all. Well, I'm going to talk to Jonathan about Chelsea, Spurs, Newcastle in quicker form and then let Jonathan go. Is there anything of those three that interests you in particular that you would like to say of Chelsea, Spurs, Newcastle? We have a big seven now, Philippe.
Okay. My goodness. In a few seconds, I don't think I possibly could. Certainly very challenging season for Newcastle because they probably haven't reinforced as much as they probably would have wanted to. Tottenham, I'm somebody who thinks that Ange Postecoglou is actually a far, far better manager than he's been given credit for by a number of people. But and Chelsea, I have to say, I'm really, really quite puzzled as to the whole plan is about. I think that, you know, the fact that Pochettino arrives, there's been again loads of movement and people are thinking, something is finally falling into place. I'd like to be sure of that. I don't see necessarily many signs of it, and I'm not absolutely sure that Pochettino's return to the Premier League is going to be as triumphant as some people guess it could be. And also I will add another thing is that we're talking a lot about the Premier League and what we are expecting and maybe what's happened in the transfer market. But there's one thing we haven't talked about and we have to talk about it, is that the interference of Saudi Arabia on the Premier League is something that's going to carry on for a long, long time. And that we probably will see other signs of it before the transfer window is over. Which is something we shouldn't forget.
Yes, I dare say you're right.
It's a very, very strange, it's a new context and also one which in which we have to understand the moves that some clubs are doing or not doing, and because suddenly there's a new order taking place in world football, and Premier League is certainly going to be affected, is already affected an awful lot by that, and that the attitudes of many clubs are already being affected by what has been happening in Saudi Arabia and what is happening from Saudi Arabia. But on this, which is, I suppose, a huge subject, a huge topic, I will leave you with my thanks.
Well, we'll talk to you again about that huge subject in more depth. Philippe, thanks very much. Jonathan,
thank you.
You can pick up the Chelsea baton, Jonathan. So Poch is in. The optimistic view here would be he's going to shift on the players he doesn't fancy, and so out have gone Loftus-Cheek, Mount, Pulisic, Koulibaly, Mendy, Aubameyang, Kante, Kovacic, Azpilicueta. I'm sure he may have fancied some of them, but they're gone regardless. And Chelsea are going to re-emerge under his stewardship as the hard-running, hungry team that Pochettino teams tend to present themselves as.
Yeah, I think that is an optimistic view. I mean, the problem is that that's an extraordinarily long list. I don't know how many names were in that list. 10 names, something like that?
Yeah, and not even all of them.
And yeah, the squad is still in the high 20s.
Yeah.
And so everything that they're doing now has been caused by the very bizarre spending spree they went on last year. And I like the idea of working with youth. I think that's the way teams should look to do things. But this is not happening in the way that you'd usually use that phrase. You would if you're saying that they've got a very young squad, it normally means that they've developed them themselves. Maybe they brought them in at 16 or 17, but they've given them 2-3 years in their youth setup. But because of FFP, Chelsea have got rid of all their homegrown players. So Mount is obviously the sort of poster boy for that. But you think in the last couple of years ago, with Tammy Abraham and Tomori, Hudson-Odoi is gone. The only sort of thing I'm saying, the only home-produced player who's anywhere near the first team is Reece James. And that I think is really sad, that one of the things you could say late period Abramovich achieved was to get a functioning academy that was turning out players for the first team squad. Well, that's gone in order to go and buy all these 18, 19, 20 year olds from all around the world who may or may not somehow click together. You look at the makeup of the squad, and okay, you've got Thiago Silva at 38, but after that, the next oldest centre back, until they brought in De Sassi last week, who's 25, is Fofana at 22. Now, Fofana's got these ongoing injury issues. If you talk to people involved in sports science, they'll all tell you he doesn't articulate his femur properly, so he's always going to be susceptible to knee injuries. I'm not pretending to be an expert, but that is what people who know what they're talking about have told me. So I don't know if that's something that can be sorted out or whether that's just the way he runs. And then you're down to people like Badi Ashile and Levi Colwell, who are both hugely promising, but they're kids. So that's a very weird way of, you spent 600 million quid and you got a load of kids at centre back and a 38 year old. In midfield, the oldest centre midfield is Conor Gallagher at 23, who I would suggest is probably not quite good enough for Chelsea. Maybe he suddenly kicks on under Pochettino, but nothing we saw last season suggested that he was somebody who'd be comfortable playing in a Chelsea team playing regularly in the Champions League. And then you think Enzo Fernandez, I watched Enzo Fernandez beginning of last season at Benfica, and thought he looked an absolutely sensational player. The way he finds space. There's something of a Luka Modric about his capacity to generate space, but also he's got an aggression. And you think, if any 21-year-old is worth 105 million, it probably is him. But it's a huge amount of pressure to put on somebody that young to lead a midfield. They haven't got a centre forward apart from Nicholas Jackson, who has started 16 league games in his life. So, and that for Villarreal, which is a very, very different experience of playing for Chelsea. So they spent an awful lot of money to have a lot of things that are promising but may or may not quite work, and I think given the expenditure, which presumably means they can't suddenly spend a load more money, I think it's a really, really difficult job to pull that together, and pull it together, presumably they need to pull together pretty quickly.
He's extraordinary when you put it in those terms. We're pretty much down to our last minute, so you won't really have time to get into the weeds on Spurs, Newcastle. Spurs have signed Maddison. He's their biggest signing. Obviously, Ange Postecoglou and then the Harry Kane situation looms large. And Newcastle have signed Harvey Barnes and Sandro Tonali. They have Champions League demands this year and expectation as well, which is new from the start of the season. They surpassed expectations last year. I guess what makes this a very intriguing season is that, as we've discussed with Liverpool, as we've just discussed with Chelsea, and with Spurs and Newcastle, very hard to know. Who knows how they're going to pitch up? And you mentioned Aston Villa as well, who you probably feel are encroaching on that big seven in a very serious way.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they finish above Tottenham this season. Ange Postecoglou, I'm interested to see what happens with him in the Premier League. I don't think he's got a particularly good squad at the minute. The Kane thing obviously makes everything much more difficult. And I like his Celtic side. I know people in Japan speak very highly of him. It's good that somebody like that gets his chance in the Premier League. My worry then, every time I hear him speak, is he just doesn't sound like a Premier League manager. And that might be some terrible sort of anti-Australian bias that's deep, deep, wide within me. But you know, he sounds like somebody who's very impressive at a slightly lower level, and then gets to the Premier League, and Premier League players are sort of, you know, what's this bloke on about?
Oh, really? So that would be my how so? I didn't realise.
It's a tonal thing with him. Well, it might just be that I'm not used to Australian managers, but I don't know. There's something tonal makes me think that are the highest level of player really going to respond to that? And as I say, that it may be that I'm fearing totally needlessly, and it's some deep wired bias that I believe all football managers should be from either Glasgow or the North East.
Yeah, were you like watching Neighbours hungover, and you just it irritates you that voice? This I thought we'd get more analytical points from you, Jonathan. This is interesting.
And then with Newcastle. I think, well, this is also a psychology thing, that, you know, the point you make about expectation puts pressure on Eddie Howe. I think they, at times, they struggled to score goals last season, that Eddie Howe's, the thing we always said about Bournemouth was lovely football, can't defend. And he's clearly gone away and addressed that. And you worry it's slightly flipped too far the other way. So Newcastle were involved in a lot of 0-0 draws last season.
Yeah.
I think teams will be very cautious of them this season, might sit deeper against them. He must be aware of that, and maybe he spent the summer redressing that, and it might not be an issue at all. But I also think it's just a problem. It's playing in the Champions League, it's not just that it's a physical and emotional drain on players. Newcastle are going to be a pot four side because they have very little recent European experience. So that means they could get a really exciting draw. They could end up playing Napoli and Real Madrid. So if you've got Napoli on the Wednesday and Real Madrid the following Tuesday, and you've got to go away to Burnley on the Saturday in between, I think it's pretty hard for those players to really get up for the game at Burnley.
Yeah.
And that, I think, could also be an issue. So I think, I don't know, I think Newcastle have to be very clear this season what their what their goal is. Are they desperately trying to get in the top four again, or are they looking for a bit of an adventure in Europe and maybe accept a slightly lower league position as a result?
And under current rules, they'll have matches which last 125 minutes. So, that'll be...
Well, and let's not forget Newcastle after Leeds, had the second lowest ball in play times last season, so presumably their games are going to be the, now Leeds are out of the league, Newcastle games will be the longest games in the league.
Yes, I would think so. We're out of time. I did want to talk to you about Everton again, looking ahead to another tricky season, and Wolves seem to be in dire straits, and there are other teams in the league I am conscious of, but we have a whole season to get into them. Jonathan, thank you so much, appreciate it.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson, football author and writer with us on the line.
Football on Off the Ball.
With William Hill. Who you got? 18 plus, see gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
The Koi Gig Pod.
You know, for a first World Cup, I think they've done excellently. But then you think of how close they were, and what if this, which is a great sign.
Subscribe to the feed in the OTB Sports app now.